Blog Talk Radio.
Joining me, I'm your host, Susan Knowles of Stand for Truth Radio, and this is Monday, February the 16th. You can find information about me and what I do at SusanKnowles.com, that's SusanKnowles.com. And for our show tonight, the call-in number is 347-205-9620 in the event that you have any questions or comments. And as always, our chat room is open if you have any questions there that you want to type. I will be monitoring that, and I can take your questions from there. As we know, there has been a lot going on in the news lately, and especially over the weekend when 21 Coptic Christians were beheaded in Egypt. We all know about, and some of us have seen the video of the Jordanian pilot who was burned to death by ISIS. Our guest tonight is going to speak with us about, you know, some of those things and his recent travels to the Middle East. He also is going to speak to us in regards to his film that he made, and it's called End Times Eyewitness, Israel, Islam, and the Unfolding Signs of Messiah's Return. He is a New York Times bestselling author, a filmmaker, internationally recognized teacher. He has a special love for all people in the Middle East and a passion to see Jesus throughout the region. He's been on the Glenn Beck Show, the Mike Huckabee Show, Dennis Miller, Jewish Voice Today, and other radio and TV shows, just to name a few. And I want to, just without any hesitation, let's bring him on so that we can just get this hour started. We have a lot to put in here. His name is Joel Richardson. Joel, good evening. How are you?
I'm very good, Susan. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Oh, very welcome. I'm so glad that you could be here. I just feel so blessed that you're here, and your appearance with us tonight is so timely. So I want to get started and ask you a little bit about your background. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, I came to faith in 1990 or 1991. I can't remember. And I grew up on the South Shore, Massachusetts, South Boston area. And shortly after coming to faith, I was at church, and a missionary had come who at the time was working in Kazakhstan with Muslims, with the poorest of the poor. And at the time, he shared about the 1040 window, which is that part of the world that has the least gospel witness, has the greatest need in terms of a lack of churches, lack of witness of the good news, you know, of the gospel, and yet it's mm-hmm. where the least number of Christian missionaries are going. And so it was at that time that I committed myself before the Lord in prayer to give myself to the Islamic world. Well, you know, again, that was 20-some-odd years ago. And in various ways, I've been, you know, working along those lines. You know, like I said, over the past 20 years, spent the better part of 94 living in Israel, Egypt, and Jordan, sort of traveling around trying to better understand these things. My initial plan back then was to come back to the States to become a missionary, go to school to become a missionary. As things would develop, as life would have it, after meeting and getting married to my wife, she has a lot of medical issues and different things that I think early on made it I realized that it was not going to be realistic for us to really raise a family in the Middle East. So, you know, I've had the opportunity to go back and forth quite a lot with her blessing and serve the Islamic world, doing my best to, again, share the gospel among Muslims. And, of course, that's only become all that more relevant since 9/11, but even more so even just over these past few years.
Now, you recently went to Iraq and just got back, I understand.
Right. We went, you know, as soon as we heard the news of ISIS sweeping across northern Iraq, myself and a few of my friends were really burning to get over there. You've had tremendous numbers of refugees, displaced peoples throughout Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, I mean, really throughout the whole region. But after the blitzkrieg, the ISIS blitzkrieg across northern Iraq, that number has just, you know, exploded throughout the region. And so we've had a desire to get over there to not just see what's going on, but to be able to minister to the refugees, to be able to pray for people, share the gospel, to get equal help. And so, of course, it took a little while to get our wives' permission to go over. But you know, we went over with a team of guys. We brought a friend that's a medical doctor, brought in probably about $10,000 worth of medicines. You know, a lot of these people, as they fled, I mean, you know, they left everything, including their prescriptions, including their, you know, their heart medicine, their diabetes medicine, their blood pressure, I mean, all of these things. And so there's a tremendous need among, you know, again, these like roughly 2 million refugees throughout the region. So we flew into Erbil, which is the city in northern Iraq, sort of the, it's not technically the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, but they do have a very modern airport. It's a relatively stable city. It's about, I want to say, 50 kilometers from Mosul, the Islamic State. And we spent some time there in the refugee camps, and then we went up north, probably about 15, 20 miles from the Iranian border, and there was a bunch of camps up there as well. We were able to visit with some of the the Yazidis, who were the peoples that had to flee from the Sinjar Mountain. Not sure how much you've been following that, but that was a big deal, and it was a great opportunity and blessing, really, to be able to meet them and spend time with them and just to bless them and pray for them, share the gospel, and it was a pretty powerful time.
Now, you know, when you were there, probably politics is the last thing on everybody's mind when you're going through something like that, but did they have anything that they shared with you in regards to their feelings, let's say, about Obama or Americans in general and how they felt that we had either helped them or hurt them or indifferent to them?
You know, I'll be honest with you. Coming into Erbil, the city of Erbil, you know, Kurdistan, we came in with bags full of drugs, and of course I travel internationally quite a bit, and there's usually some fairly stringent checks that you go through. We literally got off the plane, walked out. They never even looked at our bags. We walked up. We said we're Americans. They said, welcome, stamped our passports, and we walked right in. The Kurds love Americans. They're actually very grateful for the help that we're giving them, even as little as it is. There's a saying among the Kurds. There's a Kurdish proverb which says the mountains are our only friends. When you get up there in northern Iraq, the mountains are stunning, stunningly beautiful. But, you know, in knowing that proverb, there's also a tremendous amount of pain knowing that the Kurdish people have been persecuted by the Arabs, by the Persians, by the Turks, by so many different peoples. And so any little bit of friendship that they get, they're tremendously grateful for. Now, when I was in Egypt last year, the Egyptians are absolutely furious with Obama. And, you know, they feel completely betrayed. So, you know, personally, in my opinion, I think that America in general, and unfortunately that goes back to the Bush administration as well-intentioned, I think, as our actions were in Iraq. American action in the Middle East, you know, for all of its good, for all of the good that we've done around the world, we've really done a number, whether it be on Syria or Iraq. In many ways, our actions there have really destroyed the country and put a lot of people in a bad place. Now, obviously, you know, the past 6 years with Obama, that has just exponentially exploded, and virtually everything that he's touched has turned to crap. I mean, essentially what happened with the Obama administration, which was a shift from the Bush administration approach to the Middle East, is generally the American approach over the past, you know, few generations has been to prop up these various third-rate military dictators who control their nations with an iron fist, and there's a measure of oppression, and various people are, you know, tortured, and human rights abuses take place, but by and large, they're able to keep the peace. Under the Obama administration, there was the shift toward getting away from supporting these various dictators, these autocrats, supporting what they claimed would be more moderate Islamist governments. So as they looked for various governments that they viewed as being more moderate, they began supporting them, and the result of that approach has been completely catastrophic. So whether it's in Libya, you know, I mean, we've reached the point in time, Susan, where we look back fondly. We wish that we could go back to the days of Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and look fondly on those days. But everything that he's touched, every nation that we've gotten involved in the past 6 years is an absolute wreck.
And and a lot of people think that's intentional, and other people think that's because he doesn't understand foreign policy. And I don't know if you have an opinion on that or not, if you want to share that opinion or what your thoughts are.
You know, it's hard to say why in the world that would be intentional. I mean, you know, obviously, I am absolutely no fan of President Obama, but by the same token, you know, when I look at some of the even conservative conspiracy theories that cast Obama as wanting to, they simply don't make sense. When I look at all the various theories, you know, is he a Muslim? Is he this? Is he that? To me, really, the theory that captures who I believe Obama is probably best is Dinesh D'Souza, you know, who paints Obama essentially as a profoundly liberal anti-colonialist, and I think it's fair to say that he has communist tendencies. I think it's Marxist tendencies, radical leftist tendencies. I think it's completely fair to say that he has strong Islamic sympathies due to his upbringing. I think it's clear that he has very strong pro-Palestinian sympathies. I think there's evidence of that in his past, in his relationships. But to say that he's purposefully trying to light the Middle East on fire, it simply doesn't make sense. I think it's incompetence and you know, unintended consequences of that incompetence.
And do they have any opinion about us pulling out of Iraq, and do they want us back? Are they glad that we're gone? Any opinions on that issue?
You know, again, obviously, with us completely pulling out, that opened the door for ISIS to sweep in. But the bottom line is we have unfortunately reached the point in our country, you know, we've had the massive economic decline over the past 7 years. We reached the point where we were spending billions in multiple, and it was at $20 billion a day on Iraq. And there is a point where, you know, after 10 years or so, there's the need to pull out. Now, obviously, he pulled out in a radical way, which opened the door. But inevitably, we have been moving toward the place where it has become necessary for the United States to pull out of the Middle East. I mean, this sort of vacuum was inevitable. Now, whether it would come now or later, it was inevitable that eventually we would get there. And as we're pulling out of the Middle East, what's happening is that vacuum, you know, is pulling in other powers. And I think right now the power that is there's various powers that are sort of contending for control of the region. The region is at war right now. We have Jordan bombing Syria. We have Egypt bombing Libya. I mean, we are in the early stages of a massive regional war. But I believe that the two primary powers in the region that we will see come into significant conflict in the probably near season is Iran and Turkey. And these are the two nations that have the greatest potential to clash over that northern swath of the Middle East. And historically, those two portions of the world have always been in conflict. I mean, this goes back to biblical times, even in the prophecy of Daniel chapter 8, you had the clash between the Medo-Persian Empire and then the Alexandrian Greek Empire. And then moving forward in time, it was the Parthians that controlled that Persian, that the Parthian-Persian area was clashing with the Roman Empire, and then the Byzantines and the Sassanids and the Ottomans and the Safavids, and today it's Turkey and Iran. Geography often defines these conflicts, but there's also a deeper, even spiritual reality that's unfolding. And Daniel, it talks about the prince of Persia versus the prince of Greece. There's a demonic component to these conflicts, which I believe are leading up to the, you know, biblically prophesied conflicts that the prophet spoke of. But I really think that if you look at the contours of the Middle East right now, in so many ways, they really are lining up with that which the biblical prophet spoke of.
Mm-hmm. And are the people that you spoke with, are they, how frightened are they, I guess I should say, are they of ISIS? What are their thoughts and concerns?
You know, it's amazing how, you know, news, you know, if it bleeds, it leads in the news, and if it's going to inspire fear, it will lead in the news as well. And so here in the West, I mean, there's no question what's taken place with ISIS is brutal. The past year we've had this surreal reality of watching genocides unfold before us in real time on Twitter and social media. But by the same token, when you get over there, You know, no matter what war zone you're in, life goes on. When you're in conflict zones, life goes on. And the Kurdish people in the north, by and large, are there was not a deep sense of fear. There was a relative sense of stability, and they're not afraid of ISIS. You know, they're happy to enter into the fray to defend their country. In the flight over, we came from Germany and flew into Erbil, and there were you know, probably a handful of folks that were coming to join the fight with the Kurdish Peshmerga, that's the military, in the fight against ISIS. We even have, you know, some random Westerners, Americans, that are coming to join the fight. But the sense of fear, I find, is much greater over here than it is there. Despite the fact that we're a few thousand miles away, there's a much greater fear here than there was only, you know, 40 miles away. And I think that has something to say about American culture, including, unfortunately, American Christian culture.
And I want to ask you a question, because earlier today I spoke with Ryan Morrow, and he's the national security analyst for the ClarionProject.org. And I don't know if you remember him, but I think you've been on several panels with him before in the past.
No, I have not. Ryan's a brilliant guy, though. I really appreciate his work.
Yeah, well, he had a question, and he wanted, and I asked him if I could just say that, you know, tell you that he was the one asking it. And so that's what I'm going to do. I want to get it exactly right. He wanted to know, he said, do Iraqis have any opinions on El-Sisi, that's the president of Egypt, and the levels of concern over the Iranian terrorist militias we're basically giving air cover to?
That we, the United States, are giving air cover to?
Yes.
It's difficult because you've got, you know, obviously you've got the Shia self in Iraq. The government is essentially just a proxy. They're controlled by Iran. Whereas the Kurds in the north are, they're ethnically Kurdish, so they're distinct, but they're also largely Sunni. And so there's a great affinity between the Kurds, the Iraqi Kurds in the north, and Sisi. They're on the same side. They're fighting ISIS, and they are not great allies, of course, with Iran. Now, if you were to ask Netanyahu, he would say that Iran is the greatest existential threat to Israel today because of the nuclear issue, and I think that's true. But I think if we diminish the threat of ISIS, you know, they're both tremendous threats. They're just, you know, two completely different animals. But Iran, you know, if you talk to, you know, and I'm sure Ryan would validate this, you talk to guys that are in the special forces that have been over there, you know, they'll all affirm the fact that ISIS, these, by and large, you know, in the past, Al-Qaeda, these are 18-year-old, 20-year-old kids now. I mean, you've got some that are older, but half of them are losing the jihad just to grow out a scraggly beard. And, you know, they have an AK-47, whereas the Iranians, the Persians, are a very sophisticated, very patient people, and Iran has been playing the long game for a long time. And yet they've also been very open about their goals. They've openly stated their goals, which is to control that entire region. And they've been very systematically, patiently plotting and moving toward that goal. And so really the final step is attaining nuclear capabilities, which gives them that nuclear blackmail over, you know, all the other nations, whether it be Sisi or Saudis or, you know, anyone that would stand in their way. So when you look at the chessboard of the Middle East right now, again, taking into consideration that it's largely Turkey versus Iran for control of that region, that northern region. Now, Egypt will come in later, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But Iran controls southern Iraq. They now control the southern border of Saudi Arabia in Yemen. It's absolutely Iran. The Iranian government are the ones behind the Houthi rebels, the Houthi takeover of that nation. Iran is, of course, in Lebanon with the, you know, Hezbollah, and of course with Assad. Assad is Iran's proxy. Now ISIS, is Turkey's proxy. These are largely, these are guys that are following a Saudi Salafi religious agenda, but in terms of logistics, in terms of weapons, in terms of channeling the fighters into Syria, this is all Turkey. And there's so much evidence that Turkey is giving aid and support in many, many ways to ISIS. This is Turkey's proxy in the region against Assad, against the Kurds, because the Turks have been at odds with the Kurds, and against Iran. And so, you know, how this is all going to play out is yet to be seen. But personally, I think the first major move that we'll see, I think ISIS very well could be the fuse or the bait that draws Iran out of Iran into a full-blown military conflagration throughout the region. And I think one of the keys to that may be when ISIS really moves on some of the sacred cities of Iraq. So you've got some very, very highly sacred cities, and they're really surrounding them, Samarra and Kufa, Karbala. And so when that time comes, we've already seen, you know, just recently an Iranian general, high prominent Iranian general, was killed by the Israelis in, I believe it was in Syria. And so we know they're already there. We know they're throughout the region. We know, you know, again, in talking to some of my friends, you know, in the U.S. military and special ops and so forth, you know, there's Iranians all throughout the region where we just were. You know, I was informed, listen, you're going to be watched. You know, there's Iranian spies everywhere. They will know you're there. They don't like Americans poking around very much. So, you know, your threat is really not so much from ISIS, but it's from Iran. So I believe, you know, whether it's this year or within the next few years, I think we will see a major Iranian war throughout the region. Now, there's so many wild cards in that, but I believe eventually it's going to result in essentially a Turkish-Iranian conflict, and I think that'll be the first major international conflict that we'll see next in the region.
Wow. I want to kind of switch a little bit, if I can, right now, in the time remaining. I do want to get to your End Times eyewitness film, and I know while we're switching a little bit to your film, it's going to bring everything back anyway. So I know there are, in looking at that video, there are 8 sort of signs that show that the Messiah is returning in the End Times prophecy. And I know I wanted to talk about the just kind of start and go down the line with the rebirth of the state of Israel. Can you talk a little bit about that as one of the signs?
Yeah. Now, these are all signs that are biblically necessary. And I'm not saying that Jesus is going to return tomorrow or next year. The point of the film is to show that many of these very specific signs are, again, the general landscape that the biblical prophets speak about in that period just prior to the return of Jesus, leading up to that final few years, is beginning to come into focus in many, many different ways, specifically since the Arab Spring, January 2011. And so the new Middle East after the Arab Spring in so many ways is really falling into line with the testimony of the biblical prophets in a profound way. And so that first issue, the reestablishment of the state of Israel, and of course this is something that, you know, began, in many ways began in 1948, and so this is not, you know, this is not something over just the past couple of years, but the point is to emphasize, this is huge. I mean, in over the past 2,000 years, we're now living in a period where that which, you know, this could not be said for 2,000 years, that Israel has been reestablished. Now, among many of the naysayers, the critics, even many within the church, that would say the biblical prophecy is really a thing of the past, that we're misreading these passages, this sort of thing. What I do is I pull out, I've got in the documentary, we mentioned several, but I've actually, a book that I recently wrote, I pull out probably about 20 different guys, and I'm sure that I could probably pull out, you know, 50 more, but I've pulled out about 50 guys who are confidently declaring, I'm talking 100, 200, 300, 400 years, even 1,000 years before Israel was reestablished, They were simply reading the biblical prophets at a face value manner, and they confidently declared that in the last days, time leading up to the return of Jesus, Israel would be reestablished as a nation. So this is a essential prerequisite for the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. These guys simply read the Bible. They were not prophets, but they predicted the future. And if they could predict the future, then how much more? What other information can we glean from the prophets if we follow their example and simply read the prophets in a very straightforward, literal manner?
Well, and do you think that some of this is what's happening in France and what's happening in Copenhagen and all that, where I also read today that Netanyahu is basically telling the Europeans, the Jews in Europe, you know, come back to Israel. This is your home. You need to come back. And I know like millions of Jews are already coming back. Do you see that as part of, you know, that first sign of the rebirth of the State of Israel?
Well, it's, you know, all of these things are playing into that final conflict. You know, essentially what's happening within the larger grand biblical picture is that God himself made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But specifically, he made it to Abraham. And he promised to give his descendants through Isaac and Jacob, his descendants, that particular land. He defined the land. And the God himself actually made a covenant, a vow unto death, that he himself, if he didn't fulfill this promise, it was as though God was saying, may I die, you know, like these animals that were part of this covenant, that were these animals that were cut as sort of a demonstration of this covenant. And so really what we have, this is the foundation for God's grand plan of redemption of all the earth, you know, of the Gentile nations, of creation, of everything. And really, the people Israel, the Jewish people, they become the recipients of the rage, the satanic rage against the fulfillment of God's covenants, his plan of redemption for all the earth. And they become the focal point of demonic rage against the plans of God, and that culminates specifically in the Promised Land. And I believe that's why, you know, ultimately, spiritually, in the big picture, that's why all these Jewish people are being drawn back to the land. Now, on the surface, we could say, well, Netanyahu's using the premise of anti-Semitism to draw a lot of these very wealthy, business-minded European Jews back to Israel, this sort of thing. You know, or, you know, he's looking at the demographic issues of the Arabs outpacing Israel, has one of the highest abortion rates in the world, and Netanyahu's a shrewd customer. There's no question about it. But behind the plans of kings is the fulfillment of God's plans, and I think that's probably more of what you're asking. I think it's part of the Lord's larger plans unfolding.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the part that also has to occur, which is the rebuilding of the temple, and then also talk about the Dome of the Rock?
Yeah, now, again, another prerequisite for the fulfillment of biblical prophecy is that there would be a Jewish temple rebuilt. Now, the scriptures are not profoundly, you know, precise as far as what that's going to look like or how that's going to take place, but we know it's going to take place. In the book of Daniel, you've got four occasions that speak of the Jewish temple being defiled in the last days. In the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 13, Jesus makes it clear that that temple would be desolated, abominated by the Antichrist in the last days. Jesus placed that in the future. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4, Paul the Apostle makes it clear that the Antichrist will sit in the temple of God. Now, this is, you know, not something to be taken spiritually. Paul was, again, just speaking in very straightforward, literal terms. So we know there has to be a temple rebuilt. Christians have speculated as far as how that would take place, you know, and you've had everything in the past from, oh, there's going to be a comet that's going to hit the Dome of the Rock, and that'll destroy it, and then the Jews will rebuild their temple, or someone's going to blow it up. And there's been different radicals that have even tried to blow up the Dome of the Rock. What I draw out in the documentary I sat down with Rabbi Yehuda Glick. Now, he's a very prominent Jewish rabbi. He's been going up on the Temple Mount for years. He's an activist that wants to see Jews have the right to pray on the Temple Mount. And in interviewing him, he expressed his opinion, and this is an opinion that I've heard expressed also by some of the rabbis that are part of the nascent Sanhedrin, the reorganized Sanhedrin. It's an effort among a large number of rabbis within Israel to reestablish this ancient body known as the Sanhedrin. And some of these guys have expressed the same idea, which is that the future Jewish temple will simply be the Dome of the Rock itself, that perhaps they will add on to it, but that the dome itself sits on what they call the creation stone, and they believe that is the spot that the temple has to be. And so he is hoping that Al-Aqsa Mosque, that's the other mosque that's up on the Temple Mount, that's the lead dome, the smaller dome. Glick's hope is that the Al-Aqsa Mosque would be used for Muslims, and then the Dome of the Rock, the Golden Dome, would be used for all peoples, but it's where the Jews would offer up their sacrifices, and he calls that the House of Prayer for all nations. And then I'm not sure if you've followed the news much, but just a few months ago, Rabbi Glick was, there was an assassination attempt on him. He was shot point blank 4 times in the neck, in the chest, the stomach, and the hand. Miraculously, he survived, and by the grace of God, he is out of the hospital. I'm sure he's in therapy. But he's a very wonderful, loving, really personable guy. And, you know, 8 children, and so, you know, we're grateful that the Lord preserved his life through that. But it was absolutely fascinating to hear this possibility that perhaps if somebody would allow the Jews to use this, and the Dome of the Rock is virtually unused right now, the possibility that Temple Mount could be shared. It's a profound prospect. We don't know that's how it's going to unfold, but it's certainly something to look at.
And then looking at this second sign, the rise of false prophets, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so within the Islamic world, they have their own eschatology. They have their own belief concerning the end times, just like the Bible has its various teachings on the end times. And among Christians, there's a wide range of opinion. Well, within the Islamic world, it's very similar. But in a nutshell, the Islamic world is expecting 2 primary Messiah figures. One is called the Mahdi. In English, you could just say the Mahdi. And they're also expecting a Jesus figure. They call him Isa al-Masih. And so they believe that the Mahdi is an Islamic Messiah figure that comes back in the last days, and he causes really the whole world, or much of the world, to become Muslim. And Jesus comes back, according to Muslims, as a Muslim.
Right.
And he tells the Christians of the world that they really have had it wrong all along, that Islam is the one true religion, and their Bible's corrupt. He never died on a cross. You know, that's historically misguided. And Christians need to become Muslims. So I sat down with Sheikh Ikrima Said Sabri. He's the son of the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He's the president of Islamic and Quranic Studies at Al-Quds University up there on the Mount of Olives. And so I interviewed him about Islamic apocalyptic expectation, as well as a very unusual but prominent Muslim television personality, scholar that lives in Istanbul, interviewed them both about what Muslims are expecting. And so the point of this is for Christians to recognize that Muslims across the world, throughout the Islamic world, including ISIS, are deeply, deeply guided by their belief in the coming, the soon coming, of these Islamic Messiah figures. And what I show is that what they're expecting in so many ways lines up really perfectly with the biblical picture of the Antichrist and even the false prophet. And so it's certainly, again, something that Christians should be paying attention to in light of the fact that Jesus warned in the last days of the rise of false prophets. You have the heart of the biblical world now is infused with an expectation and a yearning for really what Christians would have to call false prophets. And so that's another sign that's coming into focus.
Well, and I think that's why it's so important too, that, you know, why the Americans want Obama to acknowledge, you know, who ISIS is, that it is a part of this belief of, you know, we're going to kill everybody or you're going to convert and believe in Allah, and without even saying that they're Islamic or have anything to do with that type of religion as a radical extremist, everybody feels that, you know, Obama is missing the point. And it's hard to fight an enemy that you don't know who that enemy is when you won't even define properly who that enemy is.
Right. Now, you know, again, in all fairness, we have to remember that even Bush really had a hard time calling out radical Muslims, and he would go on and say how Islam's a great religion, and mm-hmm. you know, that the politicians are good at doing this. Obama's
right.
really the worst. There's no question. I mean, they won't even use the word Islam. You know, to some degree, I understand when Obama's going to sit down with King Hussein of Jordan, he doesn't want to, you know, look at this guy and have him say, man, why are you bashing my religion? You know, like, I understand that
right.
to a degree. Politicians, they're not theologians. But by the same token, if you refuse to acknowledge reality, then you're only hurting your cause. And the fact of the matter is, ISIS, if you simply look at what ISIS is doing, what Daesh is doing, and you really review the history of Muhammad, you review the history of his earliest successors, the caliphs, the earliest Muslim conquerors, it's identical to what ISIS is doing right now. If you get, there's a book called The Decline of Eastern Christianity Under Islam by Bat Yor. She's a Jewish scholar. She's really one of the best scholars of early Islamic history. If you read The Life of Muhammad, which is by Ibn Ishaq, it's translated by a French guy, Alfred Guillaume, you know, which is just the biography of Muhammad according to Islamic sacred traditions. His life and the life of his earliest successors is identical to what ISIS is doing. There's no question that ISIS is the closest thing to true Islam in the earth today. But we also need to be clear, and this is, you know, this is where a lot of, you know, conservative Americans refuse to make this point, is that, yes,
mm-hmm.
there's numerous Muslims throughout the earth, King Hussein, you know, of Jordan as an example, who they view themselves as Muslims, but they're not acting in this murderous, barbaric behavior, and they're not ready to slit the throat of every Westerner. There's a
right.
lot of good people who refuse to be good Muslims. And that's, you know, that's what I found up in the Kurds. They're not radical Muslims. They certainly identify as Muslims, but they hate ISIS. They hate everything ISIS is doing, and they loved Americans. You know, I mean, we would go into
mm-hmm.
the market, and you know, I'd want to grab a pomegranate, and they would just give it to me. They would refuse to take money because they were so happy that they had friends. It was really
wow.
touching.
And it's great to hear things like that, to know that, you know, there are still, you know, good things, good people in this world, and it's not good to get so jaded that you can't see that, you know. So thanks for, you know, bringing that out and let us know. Because there's the people that are right in the middle of conflict, and yet they still have this great love and compassion for people, and it's great to know that.
Yeah.
Now, number three is the rise of false prophets and Islam's Messiah, the seat of Islamic authority on the Temple Mount. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, again, when you look at what do Muslims expect according to their sacred traditions with the coming of the Mahdi, according to their
mm-hmm.
sacred traditions, that he emerges as this Islamic leader that would unite the Islamic world, and he would specifically rule from the Temple Mount. So, again,
mm-hmm.
this is an example of how their expectations of their Messiah lines up precisely with the biblical prophecies regarding the Antichrist, who is to sit on the Temple Mount in the very seat of God. And according to Islamic tradition, the Mahdi would rule for a period of 7 years. Well, again, speaking, that's briefly the career of the Antichrist. And I have a book another book that I've written called The Islamic Antichrist, and this is really where I lay out all of these things in striking detail. We touch on it a bit in the film as well, but so many of the things that the Bible speaks of with regard to the Antichrist is predicted with regard to the coming of their Messiah. And so, again, as Christians, it's shocking information, but we have to look at that and have compassion on Muslims. They have been deceived. They have been set up. And we have to be crying out and saying, you know, if we have a gospel-centered focus rather than, you know, if our primary focus is the gospel rather than, you know, self-preservation and so forth, we have to be saying, mm-hmm. Father, do for them what you did for us. Open their eyes. Rip the blinders off so that they can see the truth. They have been set up by Satan, by their own religion, to receive the Antichrist as if he's their Messiah.
Now, and they also, don't they believe that the Mekki is already in Istanbul? Isn't that part of?
Adnan Oktar is the Muslim leader there from Istanbul. He kind of says that, he infers that he's emerging or he's hidden, he's about to come. But most Muslims would not agree with that. The Turks have a very Turkish, they sort of paint everything with a favor toward, you know, the Turkish side of things because they want to control those unruly Arabs. You know, they want to control the whole Islamic world. And so it's amazing. Islamic prophecies are vast. And so there's this huge well that they can draw from, and they can sort of pick and choose to mold in the same way that some Christians, you know, try to mold a picture to their own liking. But Muslims have a massive corpus of literature to draw from. And that's actually what makes it so dangerous, is that it's very moldable, very fluid. There are some general things that, you know, really you can't get around. And it's the perfect setup for a deceptive dictator to come and use to try to support his own dictatorship in the days ahead. You know, if he can, particularly if some leader emerges and he can pull off some deceptive miracles and he has profound military power and he can get that grassroots movement of support, get that messianic movement behind him in ways similar to where we saw our own president, you know, having that messianic swirl around him as he was coming into power, then the danger... Mm-hmm. There being a bloody regional movement, messianic movement, is profound, because there have been several very bloody messianic Islamic Mahdiist movements throughout history, and they've, you know, every time a false Mahdi claimant has come along, it's resulted in tremendous bloodshed. If we had a similar situation in modern times with social media and modern communications, instead of being localized to some part of the world, had a regional following. Well, the potential for that is something the world's never faced.
Now, the step or the next sign, number four, is Daniel 11 and the Arab Spring. Could you touch on that? I think we have touched on that a little bit, but maybe a little bit more detail on that.
Yeah, well, briefly, Daniel 11, what he does is he traces the historical conflict between what was called the Seleucid dynasty, which was one of the remnants of Alexander the Great's broken empire. And the Seleucid dynasty included basically modern-day Turkey, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and so that whole northern section of the Middle East, a little bit of Iran, Persia as well. And then the Seleucid dynasty, which there is called the King of the North, and Daniel 11 is called the King of the North, he's in conflict with the king of the south, which was the historical Ptolemaic dynasty, which is modern-day Egypt and portions of northern Africa, there, North Africa. Well, then in verse 40, Daniel the prophet tells us that this historical conflict would be repeated in the last days. And so basically we're looking for a conflict between Turkey, Syria, Iraq, or that, you know, that region of the world with Egypt. Well, you know, again, just 3 years ago, that the idea of those two parts of the world being in conflict was unheard of. For the past 30, mm-hmm. 40 years, it was unheard of. Turkey and Egypt were great allies. Well, all of a sudden, overnight, that's all changed. And now you have Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey, who's really the primary emerging Islamist leader of the region, and he's in radical conflict with President Sisi of Egypt, and they're both, you know, pointing back and forth, calling each other dictators. These are two of the most significant militaries in the region. And so once again, that general contour, that landscape that the prophets, that Daniel the prophet spoke of, is coming into focus, and it's coming into focus right now. You know, again, just in the past few years, something that could not be said, you know, over the past 100 years, and that's definitely something that we should be paying attention to.
And the next step is Isaiah 19 in Egypt, which you've already touched upon a little bit, but if you could give us a little bit more information on that.
Yeah, and this is wonderful because there's many different elements of Isaiah 19. Many of them are negative, and I touch on them in the film, and I show that they're all beginning to be fulfilled. There's issues such as civil war in Egypt, the Nile River being diminished, the economy of Egypt being desolated. But then it shifts to a prayer movement, a cry rising up out of Egypt. It begins to become a positive thing, and then it speaks of a revival in Egypt. And this is one of the wonderful aspects of getting to travel around in all these nations and visit with the churches there, is that all of the Egyptians are clear that there is an openness to the gospel in the nation of Egypt unlike any time in history. And even beyond that, there are more Egyptians coming to faith, Muslims, nominal historic, you know, cultural Christians coming to faith in Jesus and Yeshua than in any other time in history. The Egyptians are experiencing tremendous pressure with all that's gone on in their nation with two revolutions, but they are seeing a revival break out in that nation. And, you know, everybody that we talked to when we were there was just thrilled. There was testimonies, wonderful stories. There's good things happening now. And again, we just saw 21 Coptic Egyptian Christians beheaded. The video was just released yesterday. You know, with the glorious comes the gory as well, the persecution and the wonderful things. And I believe in many ways, Egypt as a nation, it's essentially a prototype for what we're going to see around the earth in the last days. We're going to see tremendous difficulty, persecution. But I believe that from that pain and that difficulty will come a cry, if the people will say yes, and out of that cry to the Lord responds, and I believe we'll see pockets of revival, even in the midst of all of the dark days and the persecution.
Absolutely. Now, the next sign is the rise of Turkey in Ezekiel 38.
Yeah, so Ezekiel 38 is a looming mountain within the landscape of Old Testament prophecy. I mean, this is one of the biggies. And so many people, so many, you know, prophecy teachers, you read their stuff, they say this is speaking of a Russian invasion of the Middle East. If you look at, you know, 10 different prophecy books, they all will have the maps and show you that it's Russia. And what I show and touch on in the film, and I deal with this in another one of my books called Mideast Beast, which is if you really look at the names that are listed according to Ezekiel, they're really pointing to Turkey and not Russia. You know, there's various reasons for how they arrive at Russia, but I show that really what Ezekiel's pointing to is Turkey. And so probably for 12 years now, I've been stating, you know, emphatically, according to the prophets, we will see Turkey rise as a regional power, and it will become Islamist. You know, several years ago, the United States was dealing with Turkey in such a way, we wanted to see Turkey replicated, that model throughout the region. It was sort of the model of moderation, a moderate Islamist nation. Well, they've really emerged as a profoundly Islamist government, and they're emerging as one of the most powerful players in the region. They have the largest army in the region. And so, again, that's a huge element of the end-time landscape that is coming into focus.
Now, we have about 5 minutes left, and we have two signs left, and we've really kind of talked about both of them, but if you could just summarize them. The one is the rise of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and then the last sign is the rise of global anti-Semitism.
Yeah, let me jump right into anti-Semitism. you know, again, so many Christians, if you ask Christians, if you say, what is the Abrahamic covenant? It's shocking how many Christians don't really know what the Abrahamic covenant is. And yet this is a foundational issue. But if you want to understand the big biblical story, if you even want to understand the New Covenant and the New Testament, what's really happening here, you have to understand the Abrahamic covenant. That's the covenant that all of the other covenants are built upon, the Davidic covenant, the New Covenant, the Mosaic covenant. And so what we need to understand is that as we approach the return of Jesus, the satanic forces that are, you know, that are very real, that, you know, we don't see with our natural eyes, that are controlling so many of the unfolding, you know, conflicts across the nations, the ideas that tend to sweep through and become trends. When we understand the prominence of God's promise to the children of Israel, that concerns that specific land, then we understand that as we get closer to the return of Jesus, the demonic principalities and powers will continue to foment conflict across the nations against God's covenant people, against his people of promise, and against that land. The demonic hatred of the Jewish people and that demonic lust to possess that land will become all the more urgent and violent and widespread. And so this is what we are seeing. Of course, it's nothing new throughout the Islamic world, although it is becoming far more virulent throughout the Islamic world, far more palpable. But now, even in Europe, it's once again raising its ugly head. And unfortunately, even in large segments of the church today, we're seeing a revival, a return, particularly among many of the younger Christians, the millennials, embracing the theology of replacement theology or supersessionism, which really is the theological foundation so often for Jew hatred and for a rejection of God's promises to the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And, you know, this theology has ramifications, political, military ramifications. And so, again, understanding that, you know, as we approach the return of Jesus, it all culminates around that piece of property. It's all about Jerusalem and Israel, and it's, you know, what's unfolding throughout the Middle East. Then we understand the various trends and ideas that are becoming so popular throughout the earth, and that's a biggie. And this is the issue that the church needs to wake up to. Because there's a storm coming, and the Christian church, absolutely, we had dress rehearsal, if you will, with the Holocaust. We had a dress rehearsal, and the church failed. You know, the church, by and large, I mean, you know, the overwhelming majority of the church completely failed. And I believe that if we are to even come close to passing in the storm that's coming, we need to radically, radically readjust our theology, and we need to understand, you know, the foundational truths laid out throughout the Old Testament in the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, and we need to understand what our role is when that storm comes, and that's to stand with the Jewish people, not merely in a political sense, although that's important, but primarily with a gospel-centered focus as we're standing against the rising tide of hatred.
And I'm going to have to stop you there. Unfortunately, we are so out of time. Joel Richardson, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I want to invite you back so we can discuss your latest book, and I hope that you will come back very soon so that we might do that. This has been incredible.
You betcha. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you so much, and God bless you.
All right, bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So tonight has just been a wealth of information. I would just ask you to go and look at all of Joel's books on Amazon.com. Tell your friends about this archive. They really need to hear this information to understand things a lot better than we're getting just in the regular mainstream media or anyplace else. So please, please do that. Have a great week. I'll see you back next week when we'll have another incredible guest. I hope you will join me then. Until then, God bless and take care.